I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Pulitzer Prize-winning author and poet, retired professor of English literature, N. Scott Momaday. His latest book of poems, Again the Farm Morning, will be published by the University of New Mexico Press this spring, and he will be speaking at St. John's College on Friday, the 25th of February at 8 in the evening at the Great Hall at St. John's. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Thank you. So you write in the introduction of your new book about the importance of the American Indian oral tradition, and I wondered if you could tell us what was your experience of stories and songs in this oral tradition when you were a young person?
When I was very young, my father, who was a full-blood Kiowa and steeped in that oral tradition, told me stories regularly, I fell in love with them. And took them for granted, as one should, I suppose, as a child, listening to stories. But they remained in my mind, and then when I reached a certain age, I realized how fragile they were, having never been set down in writing. So I started doing that myself, transcribing them and preserving them, and just developed a deep love for oral tradition, Native American and other kinds of oral tradition. So I think it was through that relationship that I formulated my regard for that tradition and for language in general.
Now, you have the good fortune, I guess, of having grown up in more than one tradition and being very fluent in different cultures. And how do you make that bridge between the oral tradition in native languages and the stories and poems written in English? And what is retained? What is lost?
A very good question. My mother was a writer, and I wanted to be a writer at a very early age. I followed in her footsteps until I was well into my adulthood. And I was exposed not only to my father's Kiowa stories in the oral tradition, but to my mother's reading and writing. So I had a foot in both camps very early on. And then when I began my college career, I was writing poetry, and I entered contests and that sort of thing, and I hung out with people who claimed to be writers. We all did at that time. You know, some of us really became writers and others didn't. But I had that in my background, and I went to Stanford on a creative writing fellowship, and I learned a lot about poetry. I thought I knew something about it, but it turns out that I knew very little and learned a lot more when I was a student there. And so one thing followed upon another, and I became a poet and very much interested in traditional forms of English poetry, while retaining my interest in oral tradition. So the two things came together in quite a natural way for me.
I was reading your book, The Journey of Tai Mei, which was republished by UNM Press in a very beautiful edition recently that also has some of your artwork in it. And the brief stories in it made me wonder, and I know really nothing about this, but it made me wonder about the structural differences between the Indian stories you tell and, for example, the fairy tales that I grew up with. They seem to have such a different sense of time, a different sense of what is beginning, middle, and end. And I was wondering if you could talk about that a bit.
Yes, the written tradition, the things that you're talking about in reference to nursery rhymes and that sort of thing, they're fairly well structured. And they are written. They are composed on a pattern that is fairly well established. Whereas, and we're talking about meter, measure, and that sort of thing when we talk about English poetry. But native oral tradition is structured on something else entirely, on rhythms and sound and repetitions. So that much more depends upon the vocal element of poetry or song. And so they're very different, and luckily they are compatible. They go together quite well. One can translate from Native American oral tradition in quite a legitimate way to good effect. So, you know, I've spent a long career talking about the difference between writing and telling stories, the two traditions, written and oral, and they turn out to be amazingly similar and amazingly dissimilar. And I would say that the basic difference is that the one appeals to the eye and the other to the ear.
So the written stories appeal to the eye, but really both to the imagination, because either way, you're kind of painting the pictures in your own head as you read or as you listen.
You've got it. Yes, that's exactly right.
The stories in The Journey of Taimei paint a picture at moments here and there of Kiowa life full of animals and enemies and hunger and bows and arrows. And what piece of Kiowa history is this telling?
I think it's telling a long tradition of, you know, that book, The Journey of Taimei, which later became The Way to Rainy Mountain, is based upon the migration of the Kiowas from the north, from the Yellowstone region to the southern plains where they ended their migration. And it is a story full of adventure and wilderness and living on the land and confronting all kinds of obstacles. And it's a very rich history, rich in the telling and in the imagination. And you know, and very few people know much about it, but I managed to write some things, and so it's sort of now become part of the public domain.
When you were young, did you hear the stories in Kiowa language?
Some of them I heard in the Kiowa language, and I had to have them translated for me because I'm not in possession of the Kiowa language. I left the Kiowa world when I was very young. So grew up speaking English, and my father, of course, was fluent in Kiowa, and he was instrumental in my getting some of these stories. He translated and interpreted for me, which, you know, the stories wouldn't be there had that not happened.
Have you, so you haven't done any writing of poems in Kiowa?
No, Kiowa is not a written language, so, you know, there is no orthography for it, and one can sort of fake writing in Kiowa, but it isn't legitimate. And one wouldn't do it because there aren't enough people who would read it.
Right. What I was wondering, and again, I mean, I certainly don't know any native languages or indeed any non-European languages, but I was wondering if, in your view, the Kiowa language fosters a different way of thinking than English, a different way of seeing. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Yes, I'm sure that that's true. That and this may be true of all languages. You know, everyone's concept of the world is sort of determined, I think, by his language, his native language. So, in Kiowa, one sees the world in a particular way, putting emphasis and focus upon this rather than that, and so on. So there are differences in the mentality of a given people. And that's something that fascinates me. We need to know more about that and leave it not only to the linguists, but we ought to get it into literature and common knowledge.
Very much so, because I was thinking about how if language structures the way you think and feel and experience things, the possibility of the poetry of that is just infinitely rich, but whether that can be translated, I don't know.
Well, you're right, and I don't think anyone does know. I happen to believe that there is such a thing as a good translation. And if you look at something like Ezra Pound's translation of The Seafarer, say, from Old English, you don't have the original, but you have something that indicates how wonderfully rich the original was. And so, you know, that's something worth striving for, there are going to be differences. And, you know, we say, well, something is lost in translation. And I would agree with that, but I would amend it to say that, well, something is gained in translation as well. And the richness of the original, I think, can come across in translation. And that's a good thing, of course.
We're talking to N. Scott Mamaday. Would you like to read one of your recent poems for us?
Sure. I just pick up one that happens to be lying here, called Rain in the Marina. I lived in San Francisco for a number of years and lived in the marina. Night at beach and Fillmore, and rain and foghorns. I love a rainy night. I look up the street where wavy colored lights waver under the sparkle of splashes, and automobiles slice the pools. There is wine on such nights, and the music of Segovia and Copeland. There is no need for sleep until the wail of a siren away in Cow Hollow intrudes upon a reverie, and then a gathering in, and then only the patter of rain on the windowpane. There, that's a sample of fairly recent writing.
Thank you so much. We're talking to N. Scott Mamaday. You have a lifetime of work and experience and travel and living in different cultures behind you, and I wondered how your experience of observing and writing is different now from the way it was when you were a young writer.
Well, I'll tell you what seems to me the major difference is that before I was retired, I was engaged in many different kinds of things, and they competed with one another, and I had less time than I do now. Having reached retirement and having a good deal of time on my hands, that's a blessing, and I have made the most of it by being really very productive, more productive in, say, the last two or three years than ever before. So I'm very pleased about that. It keeps me alive and interested and engaged in the world.
There has been, of course, every kind of destruction and romanticizing and colonization of American Indian cultures and land, and also a resurgence of Indian culture in many ways and a reclaiming of it. And I wondered in what ways and in what places do you see American Indian culture being strong and thriving at this point in history?
It is stronger and more thriving, and I think that's just a matter of course. It's the way history becomes history. You know, I was born during the Depression, and during that time, the Indian people were severely disadvantaged, persecuted. There was a kind of cellular memory of hopelessness. And all of that has changed. Of course, it hasn't changed everywhere and for everyone. But remarkable strides have been made in the Indian world. More people are crossing the boundary between worlds and becoming formally educated and becoming professional people. On the whole, the progress has been remarkable. But you know, vestiges of an earlier and more desperate time are still in the human memory, and they still have to be contended with. So it's a mixed story, but on the whole, it's one that grows better all the time.
So many, perhaps if not all, American Indian cultures have been land-based, and when land is taken away or when people are moved, there's a great deal of loss. How have people retained their culture, and what have those losses looked like?
That's another good question. The distance, the barrier between the Indian world, say, and the larger modern public world, is very deep and wide. And again, it's a matter of history happening, becoming history. Things change. It's in the order of the world, of the order of life in general. And the question is, do they change for the better, or do they change for the worse? And I think both things happen, of course, but in the large view, the Indian has made remarkable strides and has come into the 21st century in ways that we could not comprehend a generation or two ago. I just I marvel sometimes at what has happened during my lifetime. I was born in a Iowa home that had no electricity, no plumbing. We were poverty-stricken, though I wasn't aware of that at the time and didn't care. But now, you know, that world is no longer there. Things have become modernized and for the most part, better than they were. And people, Indian people, are better equipped to enter into a wider world and compete with the population at large.
In your work, I sense such a deep connection to land, landscape, elemental things like rain and clouds and so on, and that seems to, I don't know if you want to think of that as specifically American Indian, but it has such a grounded sensibility to me.
Yeah, I'm glad you see that. I strive for that, or it comes really naturally to me, because it is the Indian worldview. The man's relation to the earth and to nature in general is much much more highly developed and realized, I think, in the Indian world. You know, Western civilization is remarkable for its inventions, and it has made great strides in all kinds of areas, but not in terms of honoring the earth and learning how to live in harmony with the earth. The Indian has a great advantage in that respect because he has had, on this continent, say about 30,000 years, more or less, of experience, of tenure. And in that length of time, he has become what some people call a multiple-use conservationist. He has learned how to live on harmonious terms with the earth, and the earth is something that he reveres. It's alive. It has a spiritual vitality that seems to have been lost sight of in, say, Western civilization by and large.
And do you think that sensibility has been retained by and large, despite all the upheavals and despite all the colonization among American Indian people?
I think it has. I think it's endangered. I think we have to concentrate on how it is that it can be retained. The Indian has to change in certain respects. You know, he's not the warrior of the plains or the old Pueblo farming tradition. He's entered into a newer world and a wider world in some sense. The trick is, how does he retain his native values, which are very important, and we're struggling with that. How is it to be done? You know, how does a young man born on the Pine Ridge Reservation, for example, grow up to enter an Ivy League school and become a professional man? That's an enormous achievement. But it can be done, and it is being done here and there. And the question is, how do we do it? How does it happen, and how can we ensure that it happens? So, you know, one of the great dramatic things about the Indian is that he is constantly trying to assert his traditions in a world that is alien in some respects. How does he fit himself into that world and survive as a man and as an Indian? So when we settle those problems, we will have come a long, long way. We're in the middle of that struggle.
And I suppose the parallel to that struggle in so-called Western civilization is the people who are trying to find ways of doing organic farming and living in a sustainable way with the earth and resources that we have around us. And I'm thinking the two can and will and should come together.
I agree. I think you're just right about that. Well said.
Could we end with one more poem? Do you have anything handy?
Let me take a quick look on my desk here. I think I can come up with something. Yes, okay. Here is one old writer at thought. I think of thunder at the back of rain. I think of sorrow at the edge of pain. I think of madness, and I think again. And thought is talking to oneself, they say. I talk, and nothing comes of it this day. Therefore I mourn my muse, and think to pray. A short little lyric.
N. Scott Momaday, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks so much for having me.
And we look forward to seeing you on Friday, the 25th of February at 8 o'clock at the Great Hall in the Peterson Student Center at St. John's College. And once again, N. Scott Momaday is Pulitzer Prize-winning author and poet, and his latest book of poems, again, The Far Morning, will be published by the University of New Mexico Press this spring. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.